Wednesday's Blues by Joe Newman and his quintet from his 1960 album Jive at Five, with Frank Wess on tenor sax, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Eddie Jones on bass, and Oliver Jackson on drums, and of course Joe Newman on trumpet. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we look at foreign policy and a world of trouble today. Historian and political scientist Dr. Gerald Horn discusses some of the major trouble spots in the world today and their connections to U.S. foreign policy and globalist agendas. Dr. Horn, as you know, a familiar voice here on Lead Stories, is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. A prolific author, he has written more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. He regularly decodes complex social, political, and economic issues right here on Lead Stories. And welcome, Gerald. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start off. I always ask you, how many other books are coming down the pike? The last was about 6 that you're working on.
Well, in a few days, this book entitled The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press will be published by the University of Illinois Press. And I dare say that it will shed light on not only the decline of Black American media, but the rise of corporate media in its stead. And we'll also grapple with what I call in the subtitle the paradox of Jim Crow. That is to say that as U.S. apartheid began to crumble, these independent Black institutions began to crumble along with it. And that in itself was a detriment. And then about a month after that, this book on Black people in aviation will be published, called Storming the Heavens. And you may know that simultaneously there was this concerted effort by the white supremacists to keep people of color away from airplanes, as airplanes were then used to bomb us from the skies. And at the same time, the struggle against this kind of pestilence, in many ways, I think, will be a prelude to what might be one of the epical issues of the 21st century. Which is the plans by those like Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Elon Musk to populate or colonize other planets. And it'll be interesting to see how we figure into that scenario.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy. And we should be talking about your books. They are really extraordinarily well documented and well researched. And I think they legitimately can be said to be examples of retrieving missing pages of our history. So I look forward to that. Well, it is indeed a troubled world. And let's start at home. Donald Trump today, President Trump, has signed a bill of sanctions against Russia, which he swore he was not going to do. And in the meantime, the Russian government had said the same thing. They were certainly certain that he was not going to do it. What do you think is behind Donald Trump changing his mind? Is this a win for Congress? Has Congress finally succeeded at taming him a little bit, or is there something else here that we're not seeing?
Well, it's complicated, as they say in the United States. I mean, first of all, with regard to an issue which I'm not sure we've discussed on Lead Stories, which is how did Donald J. Trump get elected in the first place? I mean, I've usually in the U.S. left, there's a lot of critique and bashing, if you like, of leaders, be they the Koch brothers or Obama or Trump. But there's less analysis, for example, of the 63 million people who voted for Trump, mostly of European descent, and how and why they came to cast their ballot for him. Oftentimes we get sort of a vulgar economic analysis, that is to say, they were feeling the pangs of economic recession. But that's not enough, because black people have been feeling the pangs of economic recession for much longer and much deeper. And black people generally did not vote for Trump. So obviously there must be something else. Certainly with regard to the health care bill, if I can diverge on that point for a second, if you listen to sociologists like Arlie Hochschild of Berkeley, she suggests that the Trump base sees themselves as solid, hardworking Americans, and they see the rest of us as officious interlopers who are oftentimes assisted by Washington, believe it or not. That is to say, we are not actually real citizens of this so-called republic. And so when a con man like Trump comes along, they're quite susceptible to its blandishments. And certainly when they rail against Obamacare, which many saw as sort of a giveaway to the black and brown poor, without realizing that their grandparents and great-grandparents were being rescued from living in the streets by Medicaid, which they misinterpreted as just another giveaway to people of color, that only dawned late in the game, which led to this last-minute scramble to derail the attempt to derail Obamacare. Which, of course, that game is not over, because even though there are certain Republicans in Congress, like Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who are moving to try to shore up the Affordable Care Act, Mr. Trump wants a, quote, win, unquote. So he has not relinquished the possibility of returning to health care and trying to eviscerate health care for actually many of the supporters in his base. And once again, until folks on the left begin to try to understand why people vote for candidates who then come after them with a sledgehammer, I don't think we're going to find ourselves digging out of a hole anytime soon. Now, with regard to Russia, of course, Congress feels that they're punishing Moscow for this allegation of interfering in the U.S. elections, beginning with the so-called hack of the summer of 2016. But of course, I'm sure you know that the spies who have come in from the cold, Bill Binney and Ray McGovern, have issued this report that suggests that this was not a hack by Russia in league with WikiLeaks. It was something else altogether. And in any case, the U.S. intelligence agencies, particularly the FBI, as I understand it, have really never investigated the scene of the crime. That was sort of outsourced in typical U.S. fashion to this private firm called CrowdStrike, which has very suspicious anti-Moscow credentials, which would lead it to try to indict Moscow. In any case, as a result of that controversy, we see that the situation is really spiraling out of control. I hope your listeners are paying attention to the fact of there were these massive war games in Romania, a former Soviet ally, just concluding in July 2017, featuring the crack troops from Fort Carson, Colorado. This was on the borders of, roughly on the borders of Russia. And what's interesting, in the New York Times yesterday, there was this piece by the journalist Michael Gordon, who should have been discredited because of his misreadings and really just bad journalism when it came to the run-up to the Iraq War, where he says that Washington is threatened by the fact that Russia is amassing troops on its own territory. Now, if Russia was amassing troops in Mexico or Puerto Rico or even Cuba or Canada, I could see why this story would be published. This is part of this idea that Washington gets to dictate the state of play globally. But with this declining economy, that is hardly the case anymore, although it is fair to say that the remaining advantage of U.S. imperialism is the military. And so, like a riverboat gambler, we cannot rule out the possibility that Washington, in a desperate gambit to remain number one, will try to use that remaining military advantage for its own narrow purposes. But keep in mind that also in July 2017, you had war games in the Baltic Sea, involving the Russian Navy and the Chinese Navy. Now, the Chinese Navy sailing all the way to the Baltic Sea to demonstrate its solidarity with Moscow should be troubling to some. And then just a day or two ago, you had the 90th anniversary of the formation of the People's Liberation Army in China with a massive display of weaponry, with President Xi Jinping dressed in a military uniform. And certainly, I'm sure that Washington paid very close and careful attention, not least because also in July 2017, you had military maneuvers involving the navies of India, Japan, and the United States, which were interpreted widely as threatening China. Now, this came in the context of a border standoff between the Chinese and Indian militaries. You know that they fought a sharp conflict in 1962 that generally was resolved in favor of the Chinese. And already you see this encirclement of China that's developing, along with a confrontation with Russia. And if that were not enough, keep in mind that in the Persian Gulf in July 2017, you had this sharp confrontation between the Iranians and the United States in the context of Mr. Trump suggesting that the anti-nuclear deal that was negotiated by President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry was one of the worst deals ever negotiated. He wants to break out of that deal. I don't think that the partners in that deal, meaning the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, and of course the permanent members include Russia and China, will go along with that. Which means that Washington is really seeking to forge an alliance between Russia, China, and Iran against U.S. imperialism. This, in some ways, has already been solidified because Iran has become affiliated with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization led by China and Russia, which in many ways is a response to the increased aggressiveness of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And if that were not enough for your agenda, as we speak, there are U.S. bombers flying over the Korean Peninsula. Despite the order in which I've outlined these issues, North Korea might be the salient single most flashpoint in the world today as far as U.S. imperialism is concerned. And I say this not only because of the headlines you've been reading about how the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has been able to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles that supposedly can reach Alaska, if not Hawaii, if not the entire U.S. mainland, but also because North Korea happens to rest on the border of China within hailing distance of Vladivostok, which is, of course, the Russian port city on the Pacific, where Moscow has been funneling capital, helping to build up that particular city. And so in some ways, fighting or at least confronting North Korea could be a bank shot. That is to say, you could not only presumably cause trouble for China, but for Russia too, not to mention possibly destabilizing a major competitor of both Apple Computer, I'm speaking of Samsung, and Ford and GM, I'm speaking of Hyundai and Kia. So this is the state of play as we speak, and your listeners would be, it would be understanding if your listeners were to be quite nervous, anxiety-ridden about this scenario.
In signing this bill, which calls for new sanctions on Russia, although President Trump says it's a flawed, seriously flawed bill, is this really a move to kind of gain a foothold in two areas? One, to kind of chill out Congress a bit and say, listen, I am not a puppet of Russia. I can make up my own mind. I don't like your bill. It's insufficient. It's seriously flawed, as he says. So he's able to demonstrate his flexibility, his maturity, if you will, as a president who, up until a couple of days ago, was waging all-out war against Congress. And on the other hand, a message to Russia itself that he is not to be taken for a fool. He's not to be mistaken as a guy who just insists on forging new ground with Russia, for his credit, of course. But he's a man of his own mind. Is this something that you think he was thinking by signing this so-called seriously flawed bill? I can't find in my brain these days a plausible reason why he would do something that he has been so adamant about.
Well, keep in mind that that's becoming the forte of Washington. Recall that just a few days ago, a number of Republican senators, including Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, indicated they would vote to replace Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, with the so-called skinny bill. And Mr. Graham called that bill a fraud and a deception, but he was going to vote for it anyway. And so it's becoming par for the course for Washington politicians to say that they're endorsing something that they say they don't like. That's point number one. Point number two is that I keep hearing on the corporate media and the mainstream media that there is no rationale whatsoever for Mr. Trump's overtures to Moscow. And obviously, these commentators and analysts have not been paying attention to what, say, taught at Yale University. They've got to say courses in grand strategy, or paid attention to the maunderings of Henry Kissinger, who suggested that it would be inadvisable to confront Russia and China simultaneously, or in his case, the Soviet Union and China simultaneously, which led to Nixon's trip to Beijing some 45-odd years ago, which arguably helped to change the course of history, as he indicated at the time, and certainly was a step towards the eventual dissolution of the Soviet Union, which happened less than two decades later. Now, given the fact that the late Nobel laureate of the University of Chicago, Robert Fogel, suggested before he passed away recently that within decades, the Chinese economy might be 10 times larger than the United States economy, which will have incalculable consequences, not only for U.S. imperialism, but for white supremacy. It would make sense from the point of view of U.S. imperialism to try to make overtures to Moscow, particularly if you take seriously U.S. imperialism's own rhetoric. For example, Senator John McCain saying Russia is a gas station masquerading as a nation. Well, if that's true, why is Washington spending so many of our tax dollars against this gas station masquerading as a nation? Why don't they have a strategic shift, just like Nixon and Kissinger had a strategic shift 45-odd years ago? But as we know, this president, I'm not sure what to make of him in this regard. That is to say, obviously, he has no impulse control, and he tends to issue policies by tweet. For example, witness most recently his policy with regard to transgender troops in the U.S. military. One would think that if this strategic shift were in the mind of Mr. Trump, what would happen would be an address to the nation, capturing all the TV networks, think tank conferences, conferences in universities, op-ed pieces commissioned or somehow commissioned indirectly by the administration. But we're not having that. And so, and then the analysts and the commentators are not sufficiently smart to figure out what's going on. And in any case, understandably, perhaps justifiably, they have animosity towards Mr. Trump. They would like to see him removed from office, as would I, even though he might be replaced by his vice president, Mike Pence. But to revert to history, when Nixon was removed and replaced by Gerald Ford, the GOP was so weakened that they lost the election in 1976. So I think that history could repeat itself, that if we could remove Mr. Trump before 2020, I doubt if Mr. Pence could win re-election, particularly if Mr. Trump exits, as I'm sure he will, by pardoning his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his son, Donald J. Trump. and not to mention the big enchilada, Donald Trump himself. So this is what's going on. But once again, sadly, you don't hear, unfortunately, this kind of analysis coming through the bourgeois press, which is one of the reasons why this ship of state is headed towards an iceberg.
Speaking of these habits of the United States saying one thing but doing another, we have Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying, of course, we should have dialogue with North Korea. We are not your enemy, he says, to North Korea, which indicates a willingness to talk. On the other hand, he says that it is quite possible that the United States should explore regime change in Venezuela.
So there's an interesting line of demarcation
in how people talk or don't talk. Do you think that one of the persuasive arguments that North Korea has made, even ahead of any possible talks, is the ICBMs that it has now that supposedly can reach the entire North American continent? How do you read this imbalance, which is typical of U.S. foreign policy? People say one thing and then they mean another thing.
Well, before we get into that, I know you pay close attention to Trinidad and CARICOM. So I'm wondering, with regard to Trinidad, which is just a few miles off the coast of Venezuela, of what kind of impact is being felt there by the crisis in Venezuela?
You know, I was thinking of that, but I haven't seen any extensive reporting on it. And I'm watching it to see what they have to say, because, of course, Venezuela is just 12 miles off of the of Trinidad's coastline. And it did and still does have a meaningful relationship in terms of oil supplies and refining. So there is a very large interest that it ought to have in the way things are panning out. But I haven't seen that they have gone into deep discussion about this yet. Mm. So I imagine that should happen very soon.
Well, first of all, with regard to your cogent point concerning how Washington often says one thing and does another, I think that this may be an extension, once again, of Nixon's crazy man theory. That is to say, during the war in Vietnam, he wanted the Vietnamese to think that he was crazy towards the end, that he might do anything, including dropping a nuclear bomb on Vietnam. Now, I think that I'm not sure. I'm always trying to maybe this is my flaw. I'm always looking for patterns. I'm looking for some sort of logic and some sort of rationale for Washington's policy. And maybe that's my bad. Maybe it's as dislocated and as disjointed as it appears. When Secretary of State Tillerson, for example, says that he wants to see an end to the crisis, say, between Qatar and, on the one hand, and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain on the other, and then Mr. Trump unilaterally denounces Qatar, or when the United States, when Secretary Tillerson talks about how he doesn't want to see regime change in North Korea, and Washington's not the enemy of North Korea, but at the same time, U.S. bombers are flying over the Korean Peninsula. Once again, I don't know if this is part of an updating of the crazy man theory, or if really, as they say in Washington, the right hand doesn't know what the far right hand is doing. I'm not sure which one that it is. But in any case, it's quite dangerous. Now, with regard to Venezuela, that crisis, quite frankly, it seems to be reaching a boil. Mm-hmm. It's clear that Washington is salivating over the prospect of destabilizing the Caracas-based regime of President Maduro. As we know, there was a referendum just the other day in Venezuela calling for the creation of a constituent assembly, which would remake and reframe the constitutional, legal, governmental, and administrative structure of the state, there is a fierce opposition that feels that it has wind in its sails, not least because it's getting backing from Washington, but also, I would say, from the European Union and from right-wing elements in Brazil. And by the way, the right wing is surging in neighboring Brazil to the point where there's a lot of loose talk about bringing back a military regime in Brazil, which, as you know, some decades ago was ruling that sprawling South American nation. Washington, as it surveys the scene in this hemisphere, has a sense of satisfaction in light of the fact that Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party was impeached and removed from office, and her predecessor and possible successor, Lula da Silva, was recently convicted, which will presumably compromise his ability to run for that office again next year or soon thereafter. Likewise, if you look at what's been going on in Argentina, where the Peronista, Cristina Fernandez da Kirchner, has not only been forced to step down from office, but of course is now under investigation. Ecuador and Bolivia still lean to the left, but increasingly the left-leaning regimes of South America have suffered one hit after another. And given the fact that Venezuela has been a major supplier of petroleum, not only to Cuba, but to Haiti and other countries in the hemisphere, dislodging the Maduro regime could be a step backward for those particular governments. Keep in mind as well that Washington, as of yet, has not sanctioned the oil industry to a significant degree in Venezuela. And Venezuela, by some accounts, is the major oil producer on this small planet. If it does, of course, that will hamper the ability of Venezuela to export petroleum to the United States, which could lead to an increase at prices at the pump for U.S. drivers, of which there are many. And in any case, when we raise the question of energy, we should also keep in mind that the United States has become a major player in the energy industry. I should have mentioned when talking about Russia that the sanctions in particular seek to cripple natural gas exports from Russia to Germany in particular, which is one of the reasons why the European Union has objected to these sanctions. Standing in the wings, of course, are natural gas exporters from the United States of America, particularly from the state of Texas, particularly T. Boone Pickens of the state of Texas, an alumnus, a proud alumnus of Oklahoma State University. And as well, if Iran is somehow crippled by sanctions and bluster and hammer blows from U.S. imperialism, that will presumably cause its oil exports to suffer. And given the proliferation of fracking and shale, S-H-A-L-E, oil exploration in the United States of America, particularly in Texas, once again, this could be a boon to right-wing oil men in Texas. And keep in mind that this is taking place as Volvo, which, by the way, is now owned by a Chinese conglomerate, being followed by other major auto manufacturers are suggesting that they're going to try to move away from petroleum altogether. That's the import also of Tesla, the electric car that is being produced by the billionaire Elon Musk in California. So I would say that in the long term, the prospects for the oil industry may be shrinking, which helps to shed light on the desperation of these Texas oil men who have a friend in the White House, and that friend in the White House now is putting pressure on energy producers, be they in Moscow, Caracas, or Tehran.
Well, I want to ask whether you think that Maduro, in a sense, this is President Maduro of Venezuela, that he seriously miscalculated some things here and veered toward what looks from the outside, at least, very autocratic rules and rule of law, the way he was operating, seemed as if he was, there was no way to breach the political differences between the opposition and his administration. I grant that as a major point. But did it seem to you that in many instances he seemed to have crossed a line in terms of how he handled his power?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's a very dicey situation in Venezuela. Keep in mind that in terms of that vote on the referendum that just took place recently, that a significant percentage of the pro-Maduro votes came from rural areas, whereas the opposition is headquartered in urban centers such as Caracas. That's point number one. Point number two is that, like many nations in the Americas, in this hemisphere, Venezuela continues to be marked by the legacy of slavery. And you have many of what might be called Euro-Venezuelans who are in the forefront of this attempt to destabilize the Maduro regime. Many of them have allies, if not relatives, in the state of Florida, which, by the way, has moved in its own way to impose sanctions on Venezuela. That is to say, recall that during the apartheid era, there were many cities and states that said that there were U.S. corporations that had holdings in South Africa, could not deal, say, with New York City or New York State, et cetera. Well, the state of Florida is moving in that direction with regard to Venezuela. So the pressure is tightening in Venezuela. Already, I don't know if you saw the video of security officers in Venezuela being attacked. Somehow that was captured on video, and I was able to see it on my laptop, which is a very dangerous turn of events. And then recall as well what happened a few weeks ago when supposedly this rogue security person captured a helicopter and attacked an official state building in Venezuela. Now, it remains unclear if that's actually what happened, because recall that this so-called officer released a video where he was making a statement, but it appears that the, quote, soldiers, unquote, who were accompanying him in this video were actually cardboard figures, cardboard cutouts. So there's a lot of strange developments and strange trends taking place in Venezuela right now. But I would say on the level of generalization that it bears all the earmarks of what happened in Chile in 1973 when the socialist regime of Salvador Allende was dislodged and fascism was then imposed by General Pinochet for decades to come. It also is reminiscent of what befell Nicaragua, particularly in the 1980s and the 1990s, when, of course, their harbors were mined by Washington. There was a Contra war that was launched from neighboring Honduras, where this poor country of 3 million was placed under inordinate pressure. And certainly it seems to bear the earmarks of what has befallen Cuba, particularly in the immediate decades following the 1959 revolution, when there were attempts to kill, literally, Cuban agriculture and kill off Cuban animals that were used to provide meat for the population, and the Bay of Pigs invasion and all the rest. Washington takes a very hard line in what it regards as its, quote, backyard, unquote. And I would say that that, quote, normal anxiety is now being exacerbated, if not accelerated, by the growing recognition that China's in the passing lane, that Russia refuses to come to heel, that they are now in a kind of de facto alliance with Iran, and North Korea, a nation of a mere 20 million, cannot be subdued, even though it was figuratively bombed back to the Stone Age between 1950 and 1953. So Washington has quite a bit on its plate and then has the added detriment of having the Mad King Donald at the helm, who does not seem to know what he's doing and is leading the ship of state to repeat towards a mighty iceberg.
But we're seeing in Maduro, we're not seeing overt support for him from the left. We're not seeing open statements being made like from China and others that what is happening in Venezuela has the same earmarks of the previous attempts, the coup attempts, interference in the country by foreign agents and so forth to foment a coup and continuing unrest. We're not seeing that kind of overt support here. And instead, we're seeing an uneasy way of operating by Maduro. I think it's a bit troubling. For example, this election was held on Sunday, and within 2 days, we had the company that was hired to conduct the election. They're called a Smartmatic. They're based in London. And we had the CEO of that company saying that the election was rigged, and by more than a million votes. Now, you can say what you want, but that's not the kind of behavior you associate with somebody who's really towing the ideological line of being straightforward and being honest with the people and so forth. Now, we don't know who is telling the truth here, but I imagine early on the opponents had pointed to discrepancies in voting. A million votes is a lot of votes, and it's not something you would have expected Hugo Chavez to do. And one would imagine that being an admirer of Chavez and being basically mentored by Chavez, this would not be in Maduro's playbook. But it seems that there are a lot of things that are going on. The arbitrary jailing of opponents. Some people even are referring now to goon squads that are becoming death squads. These are aspects that we just would not associate with an ideologically correct leadership. So is something happening within the ranks of Maduro's supporters or within the ranks of Maduro's leadership circle that is driving them off the straight and narrow, if you will, because the pressures are forcing them to behave this way, or this is the way they have to, the path they have to take in order to survive these massive assaults that are coming from every possible direction?
Well, I'd be hesitant to accept some of the more inflammatory reports that are appearing in the U.S. media about Venezuela, for example, concerning so-called goon squads. Recall that in Libya, in the run-up to the disastrous U.S. misadventure there in 2011, there were these reports about Gaddafi's human rights violations in Benghazi. It turns out that most of those reports were fallacious. Recall that in the run-up to the disastrous U.S. 1991 U.S. misadventure in Iraq, spearheaded by U.S. President George H.W. Bush, that there were these reports about the Saddam Hussein regime pulling babies out of incubators. It turned out that all of those reports were fallacious. Likewise, I'd be very hesitant without more to accept those reports just broadcast, as I heard on the BBC this morning, concerning this London-based firm and these million votes supposedly that did not exist. I would like, given the U.S. track record and given the track record of the North Atlantic press and the corporate media, which we oftentimes rail against, I'd be very hesitant to accept with whole cloth their interpretations, or should we say misinterpretations, with regard to this oil-rich country whose regime they want to topple. Now, with regard to the U.S. left, actually, Cuba is in strict solidarity with the Caracas-based regime, which is totally understandable. They've been issuing statement after statement in solidarity coming from the top of the Cuban leadership with regard to what's going on in Venezuela, to the point where just a few days ago in the Wall Street Journal, the editorial called for pressure on Cuba in order to put pressure on Venezuela. Now, on the one hand, this reminds us of the stakes at play, that in the crosshairs is not just the Maduro regime. In the crosshairs, if somehow that regime was toppled, will be Evo Morales in Bolivia, the left-leaning regime in Ecuador. There will be stories that will then be fabricated about these two governments, and so on and so forth. And so I think that in the United States in particular, we in the progressive community have a particular obligation to oppose in the first place the bourgeoisie of our own nation, at least the nation for which we carry passports, putting our second-class citizenship aside, which is another reason to oppose Washington, that is to say our second-class citizenship. And also with regard to solidarity, I have my own personal barometer. That is to say, I oftentimes do commentaries for RT out of Moscow, and I notice that when relations with Washington seem to be plummeting, I get more calls from RT on all manner of issues. And so naturally, I got a call from RT. Presumably, you can find it on YouTube or somewhere else, where I did a commentary just the other day with regard to Venezuela, saying basically what I'm saying to you right now. And I should also mention that if somehow sanctions are slapped on the Venezuelan oil industry, that this, ironically and perhaps paradoxically, will only serve to hasten the decline of U.S. imperialism, because those oil exports will probably be diverted to China. And I'm sure that the Chinese will be happy to receive these oil exports from Venezuela. And in any case, I think that the United States, and that's all of us in the United States, not just official Washington, come with ill grace to the table to complain about the administration of elections, given the shambolic administration of elections in this country. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was was railing against Venezuela elections just the other day, and somebody should point her in the direction of her own North South Carolina, where voter suppression, particularly of the black population, is rampant. And of course, that's not unique to South Carolina. That's a national pattern. You have a commission just appointed by the mad boy king, Donald J. Trump, which is determined to enforce voter suppression nationally before the 2018 elections, headed by Kris Kobach of Kansas, who is violently anti-Mexican and anti-Latino and sees voter fraud under every bed, usually born by a person of Mexican ancestry. So I would like to see the attention of the international community, quite frankly, directed towards these fraudulent and shambolic elections in the United States of America. And once we settle and resolve that issue, perhaps people in the United States can then begin sticking their protruding noses into the internal affairs of Venezuela.
Well, I still think I agree with you. But I also think that we have to not exempt ourselves from asking questions about the conduct of things, because we've seen many well-intentioned movements adopt some really atrocious policies that duplicate the very thing that they say they're against. And we should be asking questions without assuming that, in fact, they're happening. But we should take a closer look at what is happening from that perspective, I think. I want to ask you, why is it that African leaders just refuse to go away? They're sick, they're old, they won't leave office. What's going on there?
Well, I take it you're referring to 93-year-old Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe.
He's one. You have Dos Santos.
Dos Santos is stepping. There will be three elections this month in Africa. Angola is one. President Dos Santos of Angola is stepping down. You have an election in Rwanda. Paul Kagame, who is not a senior citizen by U.S. terms, will probably be reelected, probably by an overwhelming margin. But, of course, he's a darling of Washington, and so you won't hear that much attention paid to Rwanda, even though, of course, some of his political opponents have actually died mysteriously abroad. Then you have the election that's taking place in Kenya, where Uhuru Kenyatta is running for reelection. Recall that just a few years ago in Kenya, there was significant bloodshed as that election was unfolding, and many of us fear that something similar may be happening with regard to this August 2017 election in Kenya. With regard to Zimbabwe, part of the problem there is fundamentally a split in the ruling party, ZANU-PF, a very serious and profound split. And there are those who feel that if Mr. Mugabe steps down, that the various factions will be at each other's throats, which could lead to massive bloodletting. Actually, in South Africa, you have a similar problem. Obviously, the ANC is dangerously split. Right now, I doubt if the African National Congress ruling in South Africa is on the verge of massive bloodletting if the, quote, wrong, unquote, candidate is chosen to succeed President Jacob Zuma. But in any case, looking at South Africa, and by the way, next month I'll start writing a massive book about the U.S. and Southern Africa, covering the period leading up to the first democratic elections in South Africa in 1994, but also covering events in Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, etc. What's interesting about South Africa is that it's not accidental or coincidental that you have Nelson Mandela freed in February 1990 as the Berlin Wall comes down in November 1989. That is to say that when the socialist camp began to retreat, that guaranteed that if African majority rule came to South Africa, redistribution of the wealth would be difficult at best, which would mean a further lease on life for neocolonialism and internal squabbling in the ranks of the ruling party over the scraps that the imperialists and their neocolonialist allies are not hoovering up, as they say in London. And that, in fact, is what has taken place. And interestingly enough, one of the turning points that takes place in South Africa, in a kind of, I won't call it poetic justice or anything of that sort, but it is something to reflect upon, that Chris Hani, who had been the leader of the South African Communist Party, was often thought to be a successor to Nelson Mandela, was assassinated a few years after Mandela was released. And I have a personal stake in this because Chris Hani visited the United States, and I was one of his hosts when I was residing in Southern California. And I have to say, just to digress further, that I noticed at the time that his security was not very tight. And keep in mind that this was in the midst of a scandal that was unfolding involving the San Francisco Police Department and a major pro-Israeli organization that was surveilling myself and other anti-apartheid activists on the faulty, if not bogus, premise that we were anti-Israel. Oftentimes think that after Chris Hani was killed, that kind of surveillance and the kind of poor security that I noticed in Los Angeles may have had something to do with it. But the point I was going to make is that, ironically, the man that pulled the trigger, perhaps appropriately enough, was a refugee from communist Poland who killed Chris Hani. And there you have the linkage between the retreat of the socialist camp and the difficulty in African regimes in administering the redistribution of wealth, which should be the order of the day. And, of course, this helps to feed in to the kind of infighting and squabbling, which oftentimes leads to bloodletting, and oftentimes leads, quite frankly, to what you just described in the predicate to your question, which is, say, these leaders hanging on because there's this perception that if they step down, that the bloodletting will flow ceaselessly.
Yeah, and it's also because they don't want to give up the power. It's amazing. I mean, people in their 70s and 80s and 90s. My God.
Well, let's not be ageist.
You haven't mentored anybody. You haven't found a way to pass on what you know and cultivate new leadership. You're one foot in the grave and another on a banana peel. And the idea is that when you go, well, you just go. People just have to figure out what to do. And more crisis. So I just don't understand that mentality. We have a group of leaders who at this time should be able to look at a new beginning for others, informed by the successes you have attained and the experience and expertise, you pass it on. But I just cannot look at another picture of Buhari and not think that this is really an act of selfishness and lack of vision and probably even a fear of giving up the power that you've had. I just don't understand it.
Well, Nigeria is a special case with President Buhari. I mean, there the problem is regional. That is to say, the north, which is the Muslim-dominated area in Nigeria, there's sort of a musical chairs where there's a passing off of the leadership of the country from various regions. And the north, because of seniority purposes, keep nominating these elderly gentlemen, and then they either get sick or die in office, and then somebody who's not from the north, who's not a Muslim, gets elected or succeeds that person. That's about to happen now with Buhari, and then the north gets upset, and you know that's really a special case. But keep in mind, with regard to term limits, to bring our attention back to the United States, recall that this whole term limits movement actually had started, or at least had a boost in strength in the state of California, where the Republican right wanted to get rid of Willie Brown, who was the Black American who was the speaker of the legislature in Sacramento and called himself the Ayatollah of California. And term limits were a way to get rid of Willie Brown. And so term limits were duly passed in the state of California, and Willie Brown was forced to step down. Then, of course, he turned up later as the mayor of San Francisco. It reminds me of
We have to wrap up. I got a signal that I'm running out of time.
Okay, no problem.
I'm afraid. This was particularly informative, this round that we've had here together. But I want to thank you very much, Gerald, as always. Very, very insightful analysis that puts things in perspective for us, those of us who don't have nearly the experience that you've had with following international trends and certainly the the policy, foreign policy implications here at home. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of the program. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Coming up next, Truth to Power, with someone whose name I think you might recognize. It's Charles Ortel. See you later. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.